Divine consciousness was hardly the point for my pirates. Islam for them was a group activity, a set of rules they adhered to through pious observance of ritual. Islam, like all the major monotheisms, had spread as an antidote to tribalism, a transcendent solution to the warring profusion of local polytheisms in the ancient and medieval Middle East. But Islam, for my pirates, was a clan of its own. Duhul had a fat young relative named Abdir Rashid, a plush-lipped pirate princeling who strutted around in military gear and sometimes lounged in a yellow sarong, irritating the other guards with his air of privilege. Abdir Rashid was no more religious than Duhul. In fact, both men had a taste for gin. But Abdir Rashid knew how to cook, and that was how they worked it out. On Duhul's orders, during the long, fast, somnolent Ramadan afternoons, Rashid cooked me decent meals. He carved chunks of mutton and served them in a thin pool of spiced gravy, and when I said I liked hot food, he ground the spices freely using a wooden mortar and pestle. The other guards watched with a mixture of wariness and amusement and hunger. They couldn't even chew khat while the sun shone, so they acted uneasy around Rashid's delicious-smelling meals, and they laughed when the heat of the chili made me sweat. After a few days of this new meal, I added Rashid's recipe to my collection. Garlic, ginger, dates, onion, tomato, small red chili, chop, sauté in stock, and mash. Serve with meat. It represented a gesture of Ramadan mercy from Duhul, who also ordered his TV moved into my room. For months I'd asked for a shortwave radio so I could listen to the BBC, and I liked handheld radios because you could switch them on and off. But a TV was a massive, blaring complication. As soon as Duhul's gift blinked on, five pirates filed into my room and settled in the far corner with their clanking weapons. Abdinur, Farah, Madobi, Hashi, and Zalani sat gazing at the screen like kindergartners. The satellite package at Duhul's had programming in Arabic and Pakistani. For news in English, there was only Press TV, the Iranian propaganda channel. I could tolerate about 5 minutes of Press TV each day to glean headlines, but once the screen came on in the morning, my guards would watch the news or anything else for hours. So Ramadan became a daily negotiation of TV rights, a constant armed struggle for the remote. The channel I liked best was FTV India, a subcontinental edit of fashion TV. The sight of women startled me. I hadn't seen any in 14 months. Now, on TV, I could watch a parade of graceful, refined, bloodless, long-legged women wearing outlandish clothes. As a free man, I never followed fashion, but I had gone all these months without contemplating creative work of any kind, so I paid attention not just to the alien beauty of each model, but also to the cut of each skirt and dress, to the thumping music and colors, the whole spectacle. The pirates found it uproarious. Boshko mocked the stiff way the women had to strut. He wasn't used to seeing high heels. Part of me would have laughed with him, but these glass menageries in Paris and Milan now felt impossibly fragile, a delicate counterweight to my stinking underworld, and I couldn't believe they existed. They belonged to the old civilized hypocrisy, the glitter and sexual froth of Western cities, which I missed. "Shut up," I said. "This is fucking great." Chapter 12. Islam imposed some limits on my pirate's cruelty. I find that sentence hard to write. Unbelieving bosses like Duhul may have manipulated their foot soldiers by spreading the story that infidel hostages ate pig, which was true, but an excuse to dehumanize us. But individual guards could be kind. Boshko and Hashi and Abdinasser the Sahib listened to my requests. They replaced notebooks and pens. Whenever they felt chipper, I could ask for sambusi, and they called the runner and ordered a batch from the mysterious Indian or Pakistani shop in Galkayo. I never forgot that each pirate was here to steal my money, but there were limits to the horror in the sense that none of them wanted to torture or kill the infidel. The guards appeared to waver between Sufism and Wahhabism. They listened to sermons recorded on their phones and scoured the Quran to see who was right about what. Pirate gangs and Al-Shabaab represented separate, lucrative, highly taboo career opportunities for young Somali men. Both groups had established corporate-like structures in a country with almost no jobs. A gunman who joined a pirate or terrorist network could earn a salary, make friends across clan lines, distinguish himself with basic military training, and move up in rank. Very few Somali enterprises offered so much opportunity, and I sometimes had the feeling that my guards thought and debated about the religious doctrines dividing pirates from terrorists while they sat around in these barren rooms. One afternoon, Boshko felt so bitter about news of an American airstrike somewhere in the world that he threatened to join al-Shabaab. "America, fucking!" he said. The Wahhabi challenge in Somalia was modern, oddly, the way Protestantism had once been modern in the Christian world. Wahhabist fundamentalism dated from the 18th century and urged Muslims toward a literal analysis of the Quran, motivated by a desire to keep Islam pure from corruption. Its founder, Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, took the razor of rational skepticism to certain traditions, including the idea that Sufi ancestor saints might intercede like ghosts in the fates of living men. He never took a razor to the woolly notion that the Quran might be anything besides the direct and immutable word of God. This belief has frozen in stone the most violent verses of a scripture completed in about 632. The word Muslim means one who submits to God, just as Islam means submission, and from that point of view it's undeniable, even to dull believers like my guards, that a non-Muslim has failed to see the light of a single, all-knowing and universal power. Even more universal than the word God, though, is the image of light itself, which started to seem curious to me in Somalia. The ancient Jewish levels of the soul, nefesh, ruach, and neshama, that underlie the Christian model have near-exact parallels in Hinduism, Buddhism, Sufism, and even the Platonism of Plutarch. In every instance, the higher levels are associated, somehow obviously, with light and joy. The most evanescent level of the self in certain branches of Buddhism and Hinduism goes by the name body of delight, a level of consciousness that you might think would be incomprehensible to a dirty, wretched piece of human filth stuffed into the dim corner of a concrete prison house. People have a natural religious instinct, an intuition of forces greater than themselves, a need to appease and understand. I doubt any religion has clarified the forces of human fate except in shadows. In Somalia, I could apprehend these forces as something terrible but merciful, a fantastic punishment for my ignorance that stopped short of murder. I was still alive, though not because of my own wit, and I was susceptible to unexpected moments of joy. There were mornings in Somalia that felt so brilliant and warm, so limpid that my emotions rose to the occasion. In King Solomon's language, I had lived in the house of mourning for a year and a half. I had quit working for mirth. But mirth came and went on its own, which told me that human creatures had the power to thrive in foul circumstances precisely because of the consciousness bubbling up from our limpid core. I had nothing else. Of course, I had to keep that idea near the front of my mind. It wasn't always clear. But the only source of strength in my hot and desolate prison houses was internal. If I'd focused on circumstance, I wouldn't have lasted long. The fierce American thinker and satirist Richard Mitchell once made a point in an essay about language and the limits of words. We can usefully say of hatred and of love and countless other intangibles as well, exactly what Augustine said of time. We know exactly what they are, except when someone asks us to explain what they are. This is not a defect in our language any more than the failure to indicate relative humidity is a failure in a clock. Countless such words stand as markers at the boundaries of vast mysteries, pointing back over their shoulders and saying no more. Words, like religions, just point and suggest. They're markers at the boundary, not vessels of absolute truth. To focus on the words and not the mystery in the distance is a form of idolatry, a mode of worship supposedly rejected by Muslims, although some fundamentalists indulge in it to the point of murder. Literalism is a common but fatal error that even Sufis can make, apparently, and it was miserable for me to sit around in a prison house where the word of a religion felt all important and my own language so useless. It didn't help that I had no pride to fall back on. Boudin was right when he said, "You have made a mistake." But mistakes are human was no consolation. I thought about suicide every day. Death would have been easy in Somalia. AK-47s lay around like junk. In Galkayo, the notion of grabbing a rifle to shoot a few pirates and then myself started to seem not just desirable but moral, because it would have saved a lot of people a great deal of trouble. It would have spared any SEAL team the dizzying risk of a mission. I knew that my family and colleagues were working to get me out, but thinking about so much money and trouble devoted to the cause of my freedom brought me close to violence. It still haunted me that Mustafa Mohammed Sheikh, the pirate we'd interviewed in Hobyo, may have been present at Raleigh's ankle hanging. It haunted me Raleigh had been abused after my leap from the ship, that Dixie might have turned on Gerlach to arrange my kidnapping, that Dixie and Mustaf may have planned everything from the start. Other journalists had made similar runs from Galkaya to Hobyo without getting nabbed. God knows I'd screwed up. God knows I shouldn't have come. Now I had a long time to stew over my mistakes, the way a prisoner has years to consider his crimes. But still, why me? A suicide is always a bankrupt, always a human being in a blind alley, wrote Alexander Solzhenitsyn in The Gulag Archipelago, marveling at the number of Soviet prisoners who did not commit suicide. If these millions of helpless and pitiful vermin still did not put an end to themselves, this meant some kind of invincible feeling was alive inside them, some very powerful idea. I steered around the question of suicide on some days only by cold logic. An adult who committed suicide did not obviously love you. I returned to this idea more than once while I brooded about my dad. I understood the corollary, sometimes with gritted teeth. Killing myself would have meant defeat for everyone I loved. I remembered the flaming monks in Vietnam, the discipline and detachment that expressed itself in fire. I remembered what I'd read in the Bible, the Book of Job, the Gospels, and I remembered my stoicism. Not straight from the philosophers, but from an essay about Epictetus, also by Richard Mitchell. In one chapter of his book, The Gift of Fire, Mitchell revived the ancient but surprising idea that a victim suffers only by his own consent. Whining and self-pity do nothing but screw up the pain. To be sick or to suffer is inevitable, wrote Mitchell, but to become bitter and vindictive in sickness and suffering, and to surrender to irrationality, supposing yourself the innocent and virtuous victim of the evil intentions of the world, is not inevitable. The appropriate answer to the question, why me, is the other question, why not me? This idea helped in Somalia. A sense of victimhood and self-pity in those prison houses was as easy to contract as a contagious disease. But remembering Epictetus, however second-hand, boiled a good deal of neurosis away. Chapter 13. By August, I hadn't spoken to my mother in more than 7 months, and in the poisonous environment of those pirate houses, I couldn't tell the difference between punishment and brutal caprice. It occurred to me, with a sense of horror, that my mother might die while I languished in a concrete room. A lot of people might die. Relatives, friends, presidents, popes. The pirates offered me scraps of information about the world outside, but the hot, anonymous days had smeared the distinction between life and death, fact and lie, punishment and ordinary suffering. When I asked Bashko for a shortwave radio, he said, okay, but nothing happened. Scabies developed on my thighs. Abdinur brought some kind of salve, but the condition never cleared up. Nothing connected, nothing made sense. Even though I made hesitant friendships with two or three guards, I could never expect a pirate to tell me the truth, and a diet of lies can wear you down like a diet of Big Macs. Late in August, we returned to the pirate villa, where I learned that the phone call blackout was in fact a very specific punishment. We are trying to pressure your mother, Abdurrahman said with an easygoing smile, as if sense and logic were on his side. One afternoon in September, Duhul and Eunice turned up at the pirate villa. I had never seen Duhul there before, so for most of the morning I felt jittery. He lay sideways in the entry hall, wooden prosthetic leaning behind him and chewed cot with his men where I could see him. I thought, he's here for a reason, and sure enough, we piled into land cruisers late in the morning for a long trip to the bush. We will make a video, Eunice explained, but this time the men will have to beat you up. Then you will finally go free. Oh, sure, I mumbled. We drove for an hour. The tediousness of these excursions into the Somali waste was interrupted only by Duhul's cruel imagination. We stopped near a stand of bushes and thorn trees, and the men wrapped their heads in keffiyehs, walked me around to a particular branch, and forced me to squat so they could tie my hands in a stress position behind my back. Madobe looped the rope around the branch and shoved his bare foot into the base of my spine to tighten it. I shouted. Abdurrahman aimed his digital camera. You people are insane, I told him. No one looked me in the eye. Eunice interrogated me. What is your full name? What is your father's name? And so on. When they released me, I quivered with rage. We sat for a while in the autumn sun and waited for the sky to darken. Duhul told me, through Eunice, that my mother was in the last stages of negotiation. She'd flown to Europe, he said. She was waiting there now. It will not be long before your suffering is over. I thought about it all the way back to Galkayo, where we settled in Duhul's house, and I decided they wouldn't have placed me in a stress position to make a dramatic video if they were so confident of a ransom. Therefore, I wasn't on the verge of liberty. So, why did Mom fly to Europe? Assuming Duhul hadn't lied, I could think of two reasons. One would be a wedding. My cousin in Cologne must have postponed her marriage to her longtime boyfriend because I had vanished in Somalia. Maybe she'd quit waiting. Maybe Mom had traveled to Germany for the reunion and the champagne. The other reason would be a funeral. Oma was 89. I spent several days having a slow emotional breakdown because I couldn't tell whether I should mourn my grandmother or not. I studied the men with fierce mistrust, the way a child might focus on sometimes friendly adults who also flog him. I looked for omens in the yard. I studied a spool of razor wire installed on Duhul's compound wall and watched the planes rumbling across the cobalt sky for clues to whether Oma was alive or dead. The trade-off between a book about these cruel and ridiculous people and a few more hours or days with my grandmother felt like an ashen contract with the devil, a stupid thing to entertain, and the panicked unawareness of whether I had any more time or whether that sweet woman was already gone racked my heart. I hadn't loved her enough. I hadn't loved anyone enough. I couldn't come close to repaying the lifetime of love I'd received, and what could I do about it now? Hurl myself through Duhul's razor wire? Murder pirates? Howl? I wanted to howl, and just recovering from an evil video in the bush on a grim, sweat-sodden mattress felt insufficient. I raged in silence. I had a core of burning hay. The sorrow tensed the fibers of my skinny muscles, and I was unable to sleep for hours until I just passed out. I demanded a radio again from Duhul, thinking, I really deserve something from these fuckers now. The fat boss mumbled something in his bleak voice and limped away on his wooden leg. The men must have noticed my distress. To cheer up their obviously sour hostage, they ordered restaurant food, and we all ate spiced and greasy rice with vegetables and goat, as well as sambusi, which came wrapped in newspaper. The sambusi shop happened to send big scraps of some English-printed newspaper, which we used for napkins, and I spent the afternoon piecing together torn broadsheet pages from the Gulf News. For the first time in a year and a half, since my radio had disappeared when we first boarded the Naham 3, I started to collect scraps of insight into the disheartening course of the planet. The disconnect is strange to think about now. 4 months earlier, my grandmother had fallen asleep in her house in Holland after complaining about a stomach flu. She'd placed a glass of water on the bedstand, rolled down the shutters, and closed the door. In the morning, my aunt, who lived in the house, woke up to do an hour's worth of kitchen work before she suspected a problem. Another aunt in Cologne dreamed on the same morning that Oma had invited her to open a window. "You'll like it," Oma had said in the dream. "The fresh air is nice." My good-humored grandmother died on her bed in May. I had no way of knowing that, no way of divining that Mom had already flown to Holland to see her buried in a cemetery on the north edge of the village where my grandfather had rested for years, or that Mom had spent 3 days in Europe without giving a number to Somalis or hinting to any pirate that she had left Redondo Beach. So the idea that she was waiting around for my imminent release in September, this wild idea that led to a fanciful but not irrelevant emotional rupture, must have been dreamed up by Duhul. Chapter 14. Several mornings later, after a bleak dream, I scribbled in my notebook, chicken satay, crushed peanuts, coconut milk, red chili, soy sauce, shallots, lime, rice. Bashko served me a breakfast of sullen beans and oversweet tea. Someone had cooked them with well water. I stretched out on my mattress afterward with stomach cramps, and the dream made me want to see my grandmother again. The doubt that I would, and the grief, came in long, uncertain waves. I was trying not to let the guards see any emotion when Duhul limped into the room and handed me a battered shortwave radio. Part 8. Stronger Than Dirt. Chapter 1. Over a year and a half, I had missed a new pope, a new president of France, and Syria's deepening civil war. Young terrorists had bombed the Boston Marathon, and Hurricane Sandy had flooded New York and New Jersey. Philip Roth had announced his retirement. Chinua Achebe, Margaret Thatcher, and Gore Vidal had died. All of it had rippled in the distance while I rotted on my mattress. It shouldn't have mattered, but writers are social animals, whether they like it or not, and now, by holding the radio to my ear and pacing the floor of my room, I could pick up faint programs from the BBC. My sense of the current date had weakened after the fistfights and confusion over the Naham 3's calendar pages. It had never recovered. By listening to the World Service, I figured out the real date and compared it with tentative guesses I had scratched in my notebook. I was 17 days off. The hour of news in the morning added an interlude of distant conversation to my daily routine. On some days I caught another broadcast, Radio Sultanate of Oman, and I gathered from the existence of this station that Oman had an expatriate scene large enough to demand English-language programming. The music hour featured awful top 40 hits and an odd British host who read the local papers out loud. He gave us tales of cars washed away in Wadi floods, twins abandoned in a Muscat park, a fisherman killed by a leaping stingray, and the beneficent public spending habits of certain Omani princes, all recited in a rakish Midlands accent over the galloping, whistling theme from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. His name was Fike, apparently. He called himself Fike on the Mic, and he interpreted his top 40 mandate with a loose sense of time, digging back 20 or 30 years to play hits from the same week in 1986 or 1979, which didn't always improve the song list, but sometimes reminded me of home. Blondie, Donna Summer, a band called M, which had one big hit, pop music, and Rod Stewart had dominated the radio in 1979 while various carpool moms drove me and a pack of other kids to and from elementary school. Their songs, playing over my tinny shortwave radio, conjured the cracked asphalt, the square, ungraceful cars, the fluorescent-lit supermarkets, and the cinemas sticky with spilled Coke that I still associated with 1970s L.A. A few months before my father killed himself, we went to see Cannonball Run, a screwball comedy about street racers driving across America. The film was retrograde in every way, from its gender politics to its celebrity cast, but Dad loved it. Burt Reynolds was his favorite actor, and the jumpsuited women must have distracted him from his addictions. I loved it, too. Thinking about the movie in Galkayo loosened something, a resistance or a mistrust, maybe a lifelong defensive posture against the innocent, corrupted, awkward, hopeful, stagnant, sun-beaten suburb of my childhood. I had astronaut wallpaper in my bedroom, and I liked model rockets, those cardboard tubes with plastic fins and parachute-loaded nose cones. We would set up the spindly launch pads in a brush-grown field behind our house in Northridge, and Dad came out to make sure we found a dirt patch sufficiently clear of weeds to avoid starting a brush fire. The rockets went pshht like a deflating balloon and shot into the cloud-streaked firmament over L.A. They popped apart near the top of the arc and came floating down or twisting, depending on the state of their easily tangled chutes. The tangled ones landed hard and bounced in the weedy dirt. I don't know what Dad dreamed about back then, and I never asked. While he sank into addiction, I was too busy resenting him. I remembered the bitter criticisms and the shouting, but at the same time, of course, he would have tilled his own dreams into my head. He wanted me to study science. I almost did study science. Maybe the instinct I had from age 12 that something besides a heart attack had sabotaged a man I considered all-powerful was what drove me to books. He would have been disappointed. He didn't even like to read. His late notes to me were misspelled and half-coherent, either from booze or a pain-distracted mind, and for his son to become a writer would have been a catastrophe for his Northridge dreams, for all the love he had tried to express. Maybe every suicide is an apocalyptic gesture, a last-ditch howl at the moon. Even the disciplined self-immolation of Thich Quang Duc had an element of drama, and sometimes I plotted the best way to go out in glory and gunfire. I had strong urges to do something irreversible. But it occurred to me that Mom didn't deserve to have two men in her life die by suicide. An adult who committed suicide did not obviously love you, by my own definition, and on some afternoons this line of thinking was all that kept me alive. Even such clear-sounding logic took an effort of will and cognition to arrange in my head. I wasn't entirely sane. Around this time I started to pray. Reading the Bible and the Nahum 3 had not returned me to strict religious belief, but prayer did help me articulate my most self-destructive emotions, so it became a way to balance my brain and remind myself of the forces raging overhead. It let me sort out what was and wasn't within my power. Writing in notebooks had the same effect, and I remembered that the poet Derek Walcott had once compared composition to prayer. "Any serious attempt to try to do something worthwhile is ritualistic," he said in an interview. "If one thinks a poem is coming on, in spite of the noise of the typewriter or the traffic outside the window or whatever, you do make a retreat, a withdrawal into some kind of silence that cuts out everything around you. What you're taking on is really not a renewal of your identity, but actually a renewal of your anonymity, so that what's in front of you becomes more important than what you are." This detached but inward-turning concentration became the most important aspect of prayer for me in those prison houses, rather than the belief in a personal God who could hear and intercede. Renewing my anonymity maintained my sanity. Epictetus meant nothing else when he wrote about removing yourself from suffering. "If you regard yourself as a man and as a part of some whole," Epictetus told his students, "it is fitting for you now to be sick and now to make a voyage and run risks and now to be in want and on occasion to die before your time. Why then are you vexed? Would you have someone else be sick of a fever now? Someone else go on a voyage? Someone else die?" Chapter 2. Sometimes I heard uncertain, hovering noises at night, and I woke up to find my guards listening in dead silence to a staticky phone for signals and interference. I was never in favor of cutting-edge surveillance technologies before I became a hostage, but now I fantasized about stealthy, invasive aircraft of any kind, even insect-sized drones, those insidious but supposedly still experimental flying robots that could imitate beetles or dragonflies and cling to ceilings to spy on people. On quiet, nervous nights when some force appeared to be listening, I would cross myself on my mattress and pray in a silence-breaking, conversational voice. The Somalis never interrupted. They respected prayer, though my noisiness made them uneasy. They thought drones could pick up voices. I decided to accept the pirates' superstition and use this perhaps fanciful technology to my advantage, just in case. During each prayer, I included an explanation in clear German of my whereabouts and added a description of the house and yard and the specific location of my room, just in case. My prayers, in other words, had a practical side. The miseries of Somalia hadn't stripped away a fundamental cussedness about my situation. Good and bad were reversed for hostages, as Raleigh had pointed out. "We are like the devil, they are like God." So a fuck you mental orientation kept alive our sense of right and wrong. It was hard to balance this justified rage with the pirates' arbitrary behavior, and it made nonviolent resistance tricky to practice. I wanted very much to be violent. So did my guards. One day, during Ramadan, for example, the men had confiscated my TV to watch it on the porch, where it blathered at high volume. "Hey, can you turn that thing down?" I said in a loud voice. "Maiko, be quiet!" I lay in the heat on a thin woven mat in my sun-shot room. Duhul had gone to work. The TV was a constant source of tension. I couldn't see why this supposed gift from the boss should make my life miserable while it eased the tedium for my guards. "Can you turn it down?" I said again, after a while. "Shut up!" Someone turned up the volume. "Turn it down!" I roared, and Boshko came charging in with his rifle cocked. I felt ornery enough to fight him, just out of my head enough to leap to my feet and do whatever damage I could. So it took a deliberate act of will to keep myself quiet on the floor and watch to see how far Boshko would let his temper carry him. Violence unprovoked by a physical threat was against the rules for these men, and to test their limit I had to renew my anonymity or remove myself from the equation mentally so I could locate a fulcrum point between my temper and my self-control. Near the end of 2013, Nelson Mandela died, and the BBC's coverage of his funeral lasted several days. The news electrified my guards. He was their hero, an African resistance leader who'd stood up to white supremacy. They sat there with rifles, like jailers, but identified with Mandela, who'd sat in jail. His greatness, of course, consisted in transcending both tribe and race, and the radio coverage led with his remarkable line from an interview after his release from prison in 1990. "As I walked out the door toward the gate that would lead to my freedom," he said on my battered little shortwave, "I knew if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison." Rage remained my natural element in Galkayo, so forgiveness was elusive. Mandela had noted in his autobiography that white South African lawyers and judges under apartheid considered him a kafir lawyer. Kafir is a nasty term in Afrikaans, close to nigger or coon. It derived from the Muslim slave trade. Arab traders used it to refer to non-Muslim African slaves, people it was halal to capture. The word had spread through European colonies in Africa as an epithet for slaves as early as the 1600s. I couldn't compare my situation to Mandela's. He'd suffered for the color of his skin over the better part of the 20th century without even leaving his country. But while I lived in Somalia, the label for me was Gallo, Kafir, Infidel, and in that sense, I noticed a parallel. Forgiveness for Mandela meant putting down a great deal of pride. Even when he was right, he'd learned to relinquish rage. He was a Methodist, but radio reports pointed out that he never trumpeted his beliefs, and by the time he died, no one could say in public where he went to church or how often. So the forgiveness he referred to as his real liberation from prison was non-denominational, human rather than distant, not mystical or in any sense out of reach. I had time to think about that while I lay on the floor. Chapter 3. One day in early November, I sat on the mattress at Duhul's house and leaned over some scraps of newspaper, waving away flies in the hot afternoon. Boshko sat in front of his pile of cot. He looked hopped up and bemused. At last, he asked a question. "Michael," he said, "America, Dershi? Are there flies in America?" I shrugged. "Yes, but not like this."
"Europe?"
"No, same, same." He thought for a while and said,
"Why? Nuclear?"
"Ha!" Boshko wanted to know if the United States and Europe had rid their countryside of insect pests by detonating nuclear bombs. "Interesting idea," I said, and tried to explain that the real reason was less apocalyptic. "Cleaner bathrooms and kitchens," I told him. "No goats in the street." "Of course, parts of America still have many dershi," I said, "but conditions are different."
"Malaria?"
"Small, small. It depends on the health of the animals and the people." Boshko asked me about camels, mules, cows, and goats, which led to questions about the most common meat. We discussed how to say cow and chicken in Somali, lo and digag, and I may have drawn a sketch of the edible bird.
"Okay," said Boshko.
This unusual conversation had consequences in California. Word swept the rumor kitchen that Michael's favorite food was digag, that I missed digag more than anything, and Fuad informed my mother that I had made a special request for chicken, so the pirates would slaughter one for me if she wired a quick $500. I told him no way, Mom said. Duhol's prison house stood in an urban pastoral part of Galkayo, next to houses as well as open fields, and it was common for us to hear bleating herds of goats, fussing pigeons, donkeys, chickens, and mating cats. After lunch that afternoon, I heard a kitten cry and glanced up from my notebook. I'd never heard such a helpless noise inside the compound.
"Bisad?"
I asked Boshko.
"Cat?"
"Yes."
"Mother?"
"Finished," said Boshko. I didn't want to interfere if the mother had just left on a hunt, but I had fish and powdered milk. We listened to another hour of ragged crying before I asked to see the animal. Boshko disappeared into a garbage-strewn kitchen in one corner of the compound, semi-detached from the house. He returned with a frightened young cat the size of my hand with orange, flea-ridden tiger fur. The men watched in fascination. I opened a can of tuna and set it on the floor. The kitten caught a whiff, buried his face in the meat, and let out a growl of pleasure so profound it made the pirates laugh. Good sign. A cat with an appetite for solid food was no longer a suckling. I thought he might like some milk. There was no bowl or dish, so I asked Hashi to use a kitchen knife to cut the bottom off a plastic water bottle and make a small, rough-edged plastic tray. I mixed some milk and served it to the kitten, who lapped it up, shoving the plastic around the floor. The cat must have been 3 or 4 weeks old. Male or female, I couldn't tell. Everything was too furry. But I named the creature Jack because his fur was orange, and the date was close to Halloween.
After his can of unexpected tuna fish, Jack settled at one end of my mattress and fell asleep. A stray cat was vermin to the guard, so Boshko, Hashi, and Farah found my sentimentalism amusing. Madobe came out of his room and stared at me in disgust. Once Jack had lost his innocence about seafood, we became good friends. He listened for my chains in the mornings. After my dawn visits to the toilet, he would mew and come running. Duhol noticed, but instead of banning the animal, he scolded the men in a dead and droning voice. The kitten could stay for now. On the third night, Jack angered Madobe by creeping back and forth across the pirate's mat. When, inevitably, he crouched on the porch for a shit, Madobe swiped him against a wall. I slept through this commotion, but in the morning I noticed that Jack looked ill, or at least off balance, and Boshko told me what had happened. He insisted on tying up the cat. "You're kidding," I said. "Restrain him?" "Ha, yes," he said. "Nighttime only." I glanced around the room. "Using what?" There was no answer, so I let Jack roam free. When night fell, I told the Somalis to let him go where he pleased. The next morning, of course, he was gone. Boshko tried to explain that the mother cat had returned, so the guards had set Jack free. But later I heard an alternate story from Hashi. He said Madobe had thrown Jack over the wall. "Because why?" I said. "Because Madobe." "Fucking," I said. No young animal had much of a chance in Galkayo. I knew that. I had also understood that Jack's term as a pet would be limited. But caring for a stray had reminded me of the pleasures of ordinary life. 3 days later, we heard a thin wail outside the compound wall. Someone opened the door and the kitten raced into my room. "Jack," I said. He looked frantic, frightened, and thin. He hadn't found much to eat. "It sucks out there." I opened a can of fish and he feasted like a lion. I'd missed him keenly. I tried to stifle my emotional reflex the way I tried to stifle my disgust at the fly-blown filth in my room or my urges for revenge, but even while I suppressed these instincts, I knew it was a muffled and white-knuckled way to live. The kitten got to me. He was the only creature I had met since my leap from the ship who seemed to like me. Now that he'd returned, I decided to keep him around. I dug in my bag for a pair of underused long pants, which had a belt improvised from a frayed strip of sarong cloth. I tied this soft rope around Jack's middle, like a harness, and fastened the other end to a door handle. The fabric was long enough to let him sleep on the foot of my mattress, on a flattened part of the mosquito net. Boshko threw a rag behind the door for use as a kitty toilet. This system worked. Jack established a spot and slept there. At night, sometimes he attacked my feet through the net, which woke me up, but he kept out of trouble with the guards. At last I subjected him to a bath. I carried him to the shower room in one hand with my soap and shampoo in the other to give him a lather and a rinse. He didn't appreciate this treatment at all. But in the Somali heat, his coat dried quickly, and his color changed from dun and fox-like to something like furry peach. Chapter 4 Jack had a long Abyssinian face, and he could be clumsy as well as ridiculously cheerful. He grew like a weed. But his furry nether regions failed to develop like a boy's, so I started to think he was female. "What should your name be?" I asked the kitten, "if you're a girl and all." I decided to call her Julianne, after the actress Julianne Moore, another redhead. One morning when Eunice turned up at the house, I made a joke to Boshko, out of Eunice's earshot, about the cat returning from the chaos outside to eat free meals at the house. Boshko's eyes lit up. "Eunice, same, same," he said, and I laughed out loud. The joke distracted me from an obvious fact. Eunice, as a translator, showed his face only when the bosses had organized a phone call or a video. Boshko caught me unprepared the next day with an order to pack my things. "Video, video," he whispered. He promised we would return to Duhul's, so we left Julianne in the room, harnessed, with a supply of milk and an open can of fish. We drove out to the desert bush for another pointless act of pirate theater in front of another arching cluster of thorns. These excursions took hours. They were object lessons in wasted time. But under this particular cluster of thorns, I first heard the name Abdi Yare, which the pirates had used in phone calls to California. It was a shape-shifting name, a label applied to more than one pirate, but the rumor in California was that my guards were tired of holding me. Abdi Yare had run short of cash, so he seemed willing to bargain. We returned to Duhol's and idled in the compound while the men packed our things. Hashi found Julianne in my bedroom and handed her to me in a blanket. "Bisad, okay," he said, and instead of staying at Duhal's, we drove to the pirate villa with the kitten trembling in my lap. That night I heard swirling sounds in the sky, an erratic and maddening noise like a turboprop landing and taking off. Galkayo's airport lacked runway lights. It closed for business after dark, so I think all of us had visions of SEALs using the airport for a staging area. The rolling thunder sound continued for a week and filled me with a strange and hopeful trepidation. It frightened the pirates, and one of them woke up in such a state of nerves he needed pills to calm him down. The next morning he sat against a wall in the entryway, smoking a cigarette with sagging lips, and the others made fun of him. They told me to call his name. "Hero," I said, and he just looked around, glassy-eyed. By now, I just wanted freedom or death. I was ornery enough to suffer until my price fell to something manageable. I refused to yearn for a sudden splash-out ransom of many millions, but my patience had shriveled, and I would have welcomed violence. I wanted pirates dead. These weren't my rules. Death and threats of death were currency in Somalia. Pirates wielded them for profit and fun. One morning I happened to ask Bashko for news about the Naham 3, and he came up with a surprise. "Naham 3 finished," he said. "Albedo sink." "What happened?" "Finished. All crew, Somalia." The cargo vessel we'd been tethered to had sunk, Bashko said, and the bosses had tried to run an emergency skiff to save the hostages and pirates from the foundering ship. But several of the original 23 hostages from the Albedo and about 20 Somalis had drowned. "All died," he said. "Jesus," I squinted. "Pirates no swim?" "No," I nodded. "Naham 3 okay?" "Yes, okay. Nut died. All crew, Hobyo?" Bashko hesitated. "Hobyo Haradiri," he said. Bashko's details were off, but overall he'd told the truth. The Albedo sank in the summer of 2013 because parts of the hull had rusted through. The Naham 3 stayed on the water somehow for another month, but by late summer the Somalis had abandoned both vessels. "One Chinese," Bashko admitted, "is died."
"What? Who?"
He described G, the young Chinese crewman, and said he died after a hunger strike. G was the good-humored, fey-looking kid who had made the joke about cargo when I showed him my new soccer jersey. One part of grief is fear, and the proximity of death, news of a fellow hostage, even if he was miles away, left me grim and melancholy.
"He go crazy," Bashko said. "I wonder why."
Chapter 5 Julianne was a pain in the ass, like any decent kitten. When she wandered free of her cloth rope during the day, she drove Madobe nuts. She scampered around the pirate villa yard to inspect laundry buckets and potted plants, and more than once I glanced out to see Madobe's tall-shaped lumber after something unseen, like a ball player trying to field a tricky grounder. He would bring in Julianne and dump her in front of my mattress with a fierce, hissing complaint in Somali, shaking his splayed hands in frustration.
"That thing won't sit still."
One night, a plane made a deep arc over Galkayo, and I heard the pirates whisper,
"AC!"
They went quiet and tense, and I fell asleep with Julianne perched on the foot of my mattress. Around midnight, Issa woke me up.
"Michael, come on, go out."
Groggily, I let him unlock the chains. I had to gather my things and roll up the mosquito net. Pirates packed the car while Julianne stood in the middle of the concrete room, looking confused, tethered by the long cloth to a window shutter. Bashko led me into the courtyard while the pirates emptied the house.
"Bashko," I said, "Bisad."
"Bisad no," he said, "Bisad free."
I squatted next to the car, draped in my blanket, looking up at the black, starry sky. For months I'd felt like a man underwater. For months I had drowned the most subtle and human feelings of sympathy and hope because they would have exposed me to emotional destitution. The cat had revived them. Bashko came over to explain that we were moving back to Duhal's, but he would stay behind to clean things up. He would feed the cat, then he would set her free.
"Okay, Michael?"
I shrugged. It was long expected, but not okay. We drove to Duhal's in a hurry, and I had to sleep somehow in the humid concrete room. Through the doorway and the arabesque arch, I could still see a spatter of stars. The pirates had feared a raid. I wondered if surveillance had traced us to this house. Weird feelings asserted themselves. Can they find me or not? I had no idea what the military wanted. I couldn't tell why I was still here, and there was no way to measure my own losses in character and ordinary love except by the numbness in my blood. Grief overwhelmed me. not just for Julianne, but also for G and the Albedo, and the stupid waste of lives and time that seemed to trail these pirates like a stink. I'd never seen such a powerful human force of chaos at such close range. Pirates had blinkered, selfish habits. They had a weaker instinct for cooperation than any group of humans I had ever met, and they were too shiftless and cot-addled to clean up their own mess in Galkaio, which resulted in a stupid and self-aggrandizing pirate society, a suicidal culture in which gunshots rang in the street and gunmen were winners, as Fuad had written to my mother, while educated ones are losers in life. I'd read a theory somewhere that pirate behavior tended to increase during lulls between empires, because when tension between great powers existed, bands of pirates or guerrillas had less room to operate. They tended to fall under the ordered influence of one side or the other. In periods of transition, let's say after the fall of communism, the center gave way and more forces acted on their own. The French historian Fernand Braudel had noticed this pattern when he studied the Mediterranean of the 1570s. The Spanish Armada had overwhelmed Ottoman imperial ships at the Battle of Lepanto, where Cervantes had fought, and tensions had slackened. "The end of the conflict between the great states," he wrote, "brought to the forefront of the sea's history that secondary form of war, piracy." The theory held for Somalia because Siad Barre had collapsed after his Cold War sponsorships dried up, but it couldn't quite account for the century and a half of relative peace on the oceans before the Cold War, the surprising lull in piracy that had started only under pressure from a minor breakaway republic, the United States, in the early 1800s. I came up with another theory in the hot concrete room. Barbary pirates were a fringe expression of a long simmering war between Christians and Muslims. They had existed before the Battle of Lepanto, and they had existed afterward. Tensions between empires may have let up after that battle, but the struggle didn't end for good. Mediterranean piracy was a secondary form of war that also flourished during eras of primary war, not unlike our own, when imams find political reasons to fire up their people by emphasizing verses of the sword. "Man, who in his own selfish affairs is a coward to the backbone, will fight for an idea like a hero," says Don Juan in Shaw's marvelous play Man and Superman. Sure, and ideas about the Quran gave my guards an excuse to hold me captive. But they weren't unique in the history of human rights abuses. An Argentinian journalist named Jacobo Timmerman had counted the number of high-minded and lethal ideas fueling violence in his country while he sat in a government prison during the 1970s. Rural and urban Trotskyite guerrillas, right-wing Peronist death squads, armed terrorist groups of the large labor unions, terrorist groups of Catholic rightists organized by cabals who opposed Pope John the 23rd. Hundreds of other organizations involved in the eroticism of violence existed, small units that found ideological justification for armed struggle in a poem by Neruda or an essay by Marcuse. Ideas were just indicators, like words. They could inspire a person to great heights, or they could stodge the flow of instinct and love. Some ideas worked as excuses for tribal violence. Even fine ideas could drive people nuts, which meant that the foliage of an idea depended on his mental and emotional soil. There was entropy and violence in the world, I thought, and that was interesting. But there was also entropy and violence in the human heart. One morning, Issa leaned against a wall and fiddled with his phone. He always looked pensive, so I sometimes thought he was clever, or at least less gullible than the others. Now he said, "Michael!" and showed me a doctored photo of a smiling African man with a single centered eye in his forehead. He'd found it on the internet. "Real?" he said. "A one-eyed man?" I said, and he gave a bashful laugh. It wasn't a joke. He really wanted my opinion. "No, no," I said, a little startled by the question. He nodded and went back to browsing through pictures on his phone. "Issa," I said after a while, "what will you do if I go free?" "I will go out," he said, and waved his hand. "From Somalia." "With your money?" "Yes." "When Michael is free, Issa will be free," I said with a crooked smile. "Yes." "Where will you go?" "To Italy," he said. "Boat from Libya." Stories had mounted on the radio about a fresh push of migrants to Europe. Issa stood to earn several thousand dollars from my ransom, and with that kind of money he could live well in Somalia. Did he really dream about a complicated voyage to Italy? The overland route through Ethiopia and Sudan to Libya would be dangerous and long. "Somalia to Libya. How?" I said.
No problem. Maybe he had good smuggling connections. Maybe he was just being coy.
You're crazy, I told him. This was the end of 2013. Chaos in Libya had opened paths for smugglers to move more people across the Mediterranean, and lethal capsizings had become regular news. I thought of the humanity pouring into the sea as a mass of strangers, a class of people called migrants, who would be unknowable until you met them here and there in Europe. But one of them sat right in front of me. Calling my feelings mixed was an understatement. My feelings whistled and pissed like a tropical storm. Resentment, fury, pity, alarm. Issa held violent power over my fate. He could kill me if I tried anything funny, and both of us wanted out of Somalia. But his captive would move home to the relative privilege of Berlin, if I got out at all, while my Kalashnikov-armed jailer harbored the grand dream of moving to Europe on a tottering Mediterranean boat.
Chapter 6. Near the end of 2013, negotiations budged again, and Mom had reason to hope the pirates would capitulate. She had to wonder for the first time about the logistics of my release. "We thought they might come to an agreement for $1.5 million," she said, "and we thought we'd better have a plan in place to get you out of there." She contacted a retired British officer in Nairobi, Colonel John Steed, who knew how to organize transportation for pirate hostages once a ransom had been paid. Steed ran a charity within the UN Office on Drugs and Crime called the Hostage Support Program. "Fair degree of trust required," he wrote to my mother. "Pirates do sign a faxed agreement and have only gone back on agreements twice." Steed put Mom in touch with a pilot named Derek, a charter flight operator who lived in Nairobi and had long experience with missions in Somalia and other parts of Africa. He named a steep fee, but added, "Take note that I will be totally exposed and on my own." While Mom considered this offer, her mysterious intermediary, Sheikh Mohammed, insisted on receiving his own fee of $100,000, effectively raising the ransom. Derek asked questions among his contacts in Galkayo and reported that he could verify the bosses involved in my case, including Ali Dulai and Abdi Yari, but he couldn't establish a credible identity for Sheikh Mohammed. "He does not fit in," wrote Derek. "Sheikh Mohammed is also the name of the current president of Somalia. So that does draw some suspicion. To me, Sheikh Mohammed also resembles Mustafa Mohammed Sheikh, the supposed name of the pirate we interviewed in Hobyo. Maybe the resonance was deliberate, but Sheikh Mohammed is also a cliched and common name in Somalia, almost like Fred." Several days later, Mom received a phone call from this shadowy Sheikh Mohammed, saying he was no longer in Galkayo and did not want to see Abdi Yare or any of the other bosses again. "They have insulted me," he said, and disappeared.
Chapter 7. I knew nothing about these negotiations, but Bashko and Issa insisted that my family and my governments were the causes of our constant location changes. We were still locked up together because of my clan's intransigence. Around New Year's, the pirates drove me through the streets of Galkayo in broad daylight, blindfolded, to a house protected by extra-high compound walls, with words painted over the doors indicating it had once been an office or a school. We called this new villa Abdi Yare's house. No one told me the meaning of the move, but a left-behind sheet of paper taped to the powder-blue wall in the largest room had cartoonish, classroom-style computer graphics and several lines of Somali, along with a slogan in English. "To be a pirate is to be in danger." Someone had a sense of humor. Abdi Yare's house had previously served as a pirate re-education center. Outside the front window, I could see a minaret heavy with loudspeakers. By evening, after two calls to prayer, it was obvious that the blaring sacred song would vibrate through our concrete walls like an AC/DC concert 5 times a day. It reminded me of a story credited to Kabir, a 15th-century Hindu poet from a Muslim family who once wrote a whimsical dialogue between himself and a fictional mullah. "Why must you shout?" Kabir asks the mullah, "as if Allah is deaf." Bashko talked in vague but optimistic terms about my ransom negotiations, as if he expected fabulous wealth to rain down from several glittering cities at once, Los Angeles, Berlin, Washington, D.C. His optimism threw me for a loop.
Before my kidnapping, I had believed that professional kidnappers all over the world knew that America, in particular, maintained a strict no-ransom policy. But it was news to Bosco. One day, after Somali negotiators evidently tried to lower the pirates' expectations by telling them no money could be expected from Washington, Bosco stalked into my room and said, "Why?" with a look of mocking sarcasm. "America no money?" I shrugged. "America no money for thieves," I said, and tried to explain the rationale. If governments paid out for every hostage, thieves would keep taking more. "Criminals everywhere," I said, and mimed a person nabbing a hostage. But I was no longer sure I believed it. Ransoms did fund more kidnappings, and a no-ransom policy could slow them down, not deter them. Americans, like Europeans, were targets no matter what. Greed was too fundamental. Relative wealth was its own incentive. My kidnappers were romantics who thrived on dreams of a life-changing fortune dropping from the sky. To Bosco, it seemed the height of American evil that helicopters might arrive before a bundle of cash because he listened to reports on the radio every morning about billion-dollar bailouts, catastrophic Wall Street losses, interstellar arms deals, and trillions in public debt. When they did the math, it seemed incredible that some slice of that action couldn't be wired to Somalia. The gulf between my privilege and their poverty was so vast that my own vile state, bearded and filthy and chained every night, rotting into my mattress like a castaway, was readable as the price of a poor man's ambition. These justifications did not make me mellow. They did not ease my mind. I didn't want my guards to move to Europe, and I didn't think they deserved a cent of my cash. I even thought a no-ransom policy worth its salt in Washington should require a consistent military response. Otherwise, criminals like Issa or Bosco, not just in Somalia but throughout the world, young men who heard about the fantastic wealth of the West but spent little time boning up on divergent hostage policies, who hardly knew the difference between Britain and France, and who, in any case, had seen enough government corruption to scoff at principled statements by the State Department, would never learn how dangerous it could be to kidnap a Westerner. "Michael," Bosco said, his temper heating up, "because, adiga, aniga, no America, no Europe. Because of you," he was saying, "I can't go to America. I can't go to Europe." "Because of me?" I said. "Why?" Drones around the Naham 3 had photographed him while he guarded us on the upper deck, he said. He was a recognizable pirate. His face would be in databases, and for the rest of his life he would have to stay out of the most promising nations on Earth. Bosco's international prospects were dimmed, and it was all Michael's fault. "I did not kidnap me," I told him. "I did not make you a pirate." "Because, adiga, Somalia," he shouted in our broken language. "Because you came to Somalia." "Fucking." "Fucking," I agreed. One afternoon I glanced up from my mattress at Abdi Yare's house and noticed that Bosco had left the room. His rifle lay on a mat. I considered grabbing it. The room was large and empty, with a glare of sunlight streaming in from the concrete yard. I tried to judge from the sound of movements and hushed voices where the guards were. They would have bedded down in two separate rooms. Bosco came in, noticed the gun, picked it up nimbly by the muzzle, and sat down with a brilliant smile. "Problem," he said, meaning the unattended firearm. I smiled back. The house was silent that afternoon because an Orion had flown overhead. Bosco rested his rifle behind him. He locked his elbows around his knees and munched a stem of cot. His eyes were fervid. I had just been wondering how many of the guards I could shoot before they got to me. "Michael," he said, "America coming? Adiga finished. If the Americans come, you will be killed." "I know." "Why no money?" he said. I shrugged. Chapter 8. From my mattress at Abdi Yare's house, I could sometimes see the moon, large and blurry, like a fat silver lantern over the compound wall. The light spilled in through a metal screen. Moon sightings were so rare for me in Somalia, they came as a shock. The prison houses kept me locked away from the drama of the natural world. I couldn't count the number of clear moonstruck nights I had missed in Somalia, or, even worse, the number I had left to enjoy. Somewhere in Paul Bowles' novel, The Sheltering Sky, the lead character wonders the same thing. Everything happens only a certain number of times, and a very small number, really, he says. How many more times will you remember a certain afternoon of your childhood, an afternoon that is so deeply a part of your being that you can't even conceive of your life without it? Perhaps 4, 5 times more, perhaps not even that. How many more times will you watch the full moon rise? Perhaps 20. I wondered if Mom could see the